Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
I want everyone to know, I can't let this be lost to time. It's just too perfect. I want everyone to know that right before the show, Michael Kester, who is joining us today, by the way. Michael Kester. Hi, Michael. Michael Kester advised me to smash that describe.
I did say smash that describe button.
In fact, I think you were correcting me because I made one of those.
Yeah, you said smash that like. Right. Yeah.
Well, there's no jokes left. You know, that's the problem with today is that...
Smash that Cybertruck button.
Is that I'm just saying what a million other people have said. We all just make these lazy... They're not even jokes. They're just stupid things that everyone says now.
Mm-hmm.
You just say, smash that subscribe.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to further abstract my relevance. And in doing it, you felt the need to correct me with smash that describe, which sounds like John's job. John is supposed to go on doublefeature.fm and smash that describe.
Yeah.
So,
but what's really exciting is every once in a while you accidentally come up with a phrase that no one's ever said before. So I think smash that describe falls in that category.
If it isn't a phrase no one's ever said before, it fucking should be. So, I never mentioned this on the show, but our descriptions that after 1 million long years of doing this show were just me incoherently rambling. John's been writing those, and they are way better.
Cool.
They are semi-accurate.
True.
They say what happened in the show, and they help me remember what the fuck we did on Double Feature, so that's always great.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck are we doing today? Oh, by the way, I'm back in America. Isn't this wonderful?
Look at that. Does that have anything to do with our Patreon? I suspect the answer is no.
I was going to highlight what we're doing on the show first, but I also want to talk about this as a double feature today. So maybe let's get this Patreon out of the way. I was going on the, now that I'm back home, now that I've returned to America, I could check on our Patreon. So I pulled it up.
Mm-hmm.
I've got all the equipment here in front of me to do things like check a Patreon. And I noticed that there are only 7 people. So I wanted to let everybody know, I should say only 7 executive producers. There are more than 7 people on our Patreon. I really fucked that up, but hopefully I issued my correction rapidly enough. There are many people on the Patreon, 7 of which are executive producers. Hey, maybe you want to slip into a higher tier.
Slip into something more comfortable.
Slip into
the higher tiers offer more comfort.
Slip into something more executive. You can be an executive producer. It's patreon.com/doublefeature. And we will read your names right here on the show. There's only 7 people who shouldn't be an executive producer. If you're not currently one and you can hear the sound of my voice, then patreon.com/doublefeature. I wanted to highlight that not just because a few of our executive producers, I assume, died in horrible accidents. Their bodies completely mangled, unrecognizable, these people. But don't look at me like that. You make me feel bad. I was totally fine with that joke until you were like, what are you doing? No, I mean, I say that because we are no longer at the threshold that we need to be in order to do double feature. Not great.
Which
not
is
great.
No, it's not ideal.
No.
However, I'll tell you one thing, not to bum everybody out, but there are worse shows to go out on than The Big Sick and The Lovely Bones.
Hey, there's still an opportunity to make this the worst show to go out on, so.
That's true.
Don't challenge me, Michael.
But by doo-wop rules, Big Sick and The Lovely Bones, arguably the best doo-wop band we've come up
with.
Okay,
if the movie was called Big Sick, that is not.
Yeah.
We're doing these two movies here, The Big Sick and The Lovely Bones.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit about this. I think we might be in a bubble here.
Uh-oh.
I wanted to talk a little bit about this as a double feature, and I kind of wanted the listeners to weigh in.
Okay.
double feature show at iCloud.com.
We're doing this live, so get on there quick.
not live. But as I have been pitching this double feature to people in my life, I thought, and I said this to you, we kind of came up with this last minute. I'm flying and stuff. We're like barely able to pull this show together. Here's two movies. We want to talk about the stuff in them. They'll probably go together. Let's do it. And after watching them, I said to you, that turned out really well.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody I tell about this double feature, I talk to about this double feature, they shake their head at me. Like, why would you pair those two movies together?
Perfect. Now, it's a perfect pair.
My thought after watching them was these are both movies where a person central to the narrative disappears, and it is about mm-hmm. the emotional vacuum, this sort of fucking chaos that is left when somebody vanishes for whatever reason from our lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie where the supporting characters are the main
yep.
characters.
It also adds a nice little fun narrative doing it in this order where one character is removed from the film and we watch other people essentially try and figure out what to do. And then the second film goes, maybe this is what's going on in that non-character's existence right now. You know, that a removed character still plays a vital role in the actual storytelling.
So these seem like great reasons, but this is what I wondered about being in a bubble, because those are great reasons if you've already done a million double features. But if you're just a normal human and you're going to, if you walk by a movie marquee and they're like, hey, buy one ticket and you can see both The Big Sick and The Lovely Bones, it is possible that people go, why the fuck would you watch both of those movies back to back? I don't know. I'm curious what makes that, you know, what's the difference? Is it just like a tone thing? I assume most people don't go, here's a thematic idea. And also the vacancy of a character here is sort of the inverse proportion of the character in the...
Sure.
It must be that normal audiences don't think about movies this way.
I mean, yeah, that's the thing. Like, the whole point of the show is not, you know, a marquee of a double feature is all well and good. And that's sort of where the double features that we did at like my apartment in Chicago came from.
Mm-hmm.
Like, holy shit, these two movies are going to go together really well. We did, you know, I can't think of, what was it? Feast and we'd Feast with something. And it was like this perfect like creature feature good. Nonsense.
Did you really,
It was Feast in the Descent. That okay. was the first one,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Like, sure. But quickly, the second double feature, I don't know if you remember this, was Shoot 'Em Up and Children of Men.
Oh, yeah. Right. Because immediately we went into, isn't this funny? It's the same guy thing about babies.
Doing the We're same doing, thing.
Yeah. It really doesn't take
different
long.
Tones. Like, yeah. Fuck you. Like, tones are narrative tools. They're not the backbone of a film.
Well, ultimately, it is up to us to pick the best double features to produce episodes of the show. And if, you know, the best kind of double features just out in the world, I think tend to be two movies that are as similar as possible, which, as we've learned early and often, is not the best way to do a show, because then you just
right.
do half a show and say everything you just fucking said again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice if there's, you know, if you can flip something or create an inverse or do two things that come at the same idea from a different perspective, or the opposite of that.
Sure.
So if you're just scrolling back through the back catalog and watching the movies and not listening to the show is maybe not a great idea.
Right.
I want to advise against those kind of spoilers today, where people skip the show but watch the movies, but also don't skip the movies and listen to the show. Because we will spoil, here it is, we will spoil The Big Sick coming up right now. We'll spoil The Lovely Bones. Thank you for indulging me on, you know, it's just good every couple hundred episodes to sit down and think about what
sure.
we're doing here, you know?
Right, that's fair. That's a fair point.
Really make sure.
Yeah.
All right, can I tell you, I teased this to you before the show. I want to confess something to you. I told you I didn't have a lot of...
You haven't seen the movies. Okay.
I did watch both the movies because I am a fucking professional.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a very long plane ride. No. I watched these at home, and The Big Sick, I told you I didn't have a lot of notes on. And I just want to be I just want to be 100% honest with you about this. That is because I cried the entire fucking way through this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just, it hit me like I was being, you ever just get like a pain, you know? And you're just like, oh, mm-hmm. oh, what, ow, what is that? Ow. That's how the emotion of The Big Sick got to me, where suddenly I'm just watching it. I'm having a, oh, Ray Romano, okay. And then suddenly I'm just bawling for no reason, not like a mm-hmm. quick rise up, just like somebody smacked tears out of my eyes. And I don't know if I'm just emotionally raw or what the fuck is going on here. But man, they'd make a decision about moving her to a different hospital, or somebody would just say something. Fuck, man.
Yeah.
Intense.
So one of the things that really makes this movie that emotionally gripping is, okay, so let's just get this out of the way. And I don't think that this is particularly instrumental, but it's based on a true story, and furthermore based on a true story about the main character of the film, right? So Kumail Nanjiani met his wife this way. This is essentially a dramatization of how he met his wife, who is the comatose character for the majority of the film. So sure, there's a certain aspect of The Big Sick that is compelling because you know it really happened. And as soon as you know something really happened or believe something really happened, suddenly you take it for face value. It's a little bit harder to roll your eyes. But I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested in is taking these characters, particularly Kumail Nanjiani and his future wife's parents, throwing them into a film before they've actually ever met, and then removing the only thing that connects those two sets of people to each other, but forcing them to stay in the same room. The reason that that's compelling to me as a person who doesn't like to meet humans is the palpable social anxiety of being in a room with two. So what you can take at the beginning of the eponymous Big Sick, once the character is Emily is in a coma, you know that Kumail and her parents both love her essentially the same amount, right? Let's say 100% of love, right? Max love. They both love her. They have this incredibly strong thing in common. That aside, nothing else. And furthermore, the character with no other support is disliked by the other two characters going into the room.
Yeah.
And the way that the narrative is presented is we are incredibly sympathetic to Kumail's rationale for breaking things off anyway, especially if it's you and I who are strong atheists and believe that things like religious-based dogmas and things like this, or even honestly like culturally-based dogmas, are dictating the lives of younger generations, right? Mm-hmm. So automatically, like, I think you and I relate to, oh my God, my parents are trying to lead me down a path I don't want to follow. For one reason or another, you and I have that in common. I think most people watching this film have that in common. So that endears us to Kumail's character, who then becomes the character with no support but the audience who can't reach him.
Well, and I'll also say from a writing standpoint, I think it's very important that he doesn't want to be in that situation.
Right.
He's doing it, and this is, you know, perfect. He's doing it to appease his parents. He's doing it because of a relationship with his parents.
Mm-hmm.
There's a notion for him of staying with his family that is very, very important. And he revisits that a couple times. I mean, of course, there's that fucking pivotal moment of him coming back and basically announcing that it needs to be a unanimous vote, and he does not vote to kick himself out of the family, which is fucking wonderful. The cue cards are wonderful. Like, there is somebody who has to like meeting people, has to like being around people, because it's
sure.
Just, how could you not? How do you not win over a room with those cue cards? You know, it's
right.
Just so perfect. And so that idea of family, we only really see the true scope of how important that is to him by that moment in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But because he's essentially doing this for his family and he himself doesn't like it, then basically, when he's confronted by Emily, what's this pile of women in your room? You know, we understand where he's coming from, I think. I think everybody is mm-hmm. sympathetic, not just of the open-minded, hey, we're going to go out on a limb here on Double Feature and say neither of the hosts likes arranged marriage. Aren't we progressive? Mm-hmm. I don't even think you have to agree that far. I think you just have to go, oh, he's in this spot. He doesn't like being here. But the crux of that scene, where the push and pull of that scene is that Emily doesn't know that.
Right.
And for her, it's more about keeping secrets and it's about setting off red flags. This is kind of the power, I think, of following him a little bit more in that narrative. And also interesting to me because I think there's probably a version of the movie that plays from her side where
sure.
we can completely 100% see. I think she has a very compelling case, right? I think we've all been in relationships where we get a lot of warning signs and then we're like, what the fuck? I should have known. First time something goes bad, you know, I don't know if this is also universal for you, but that's the first thing I think is like, man, the fucking signs. I should have seen the signs. I'm such an idiot, you know?
Sure.
And then also, you know, I think one of the most compelling points of that argument, really what makes this setup interesting emotionally for the plot points it hits is that he has his whole arc. He has this holy bonds with her parents. He's there every day. And we feel all of these emotions of him waiting on her and hoping she gets better and being invested in her case and protecting her when they want to move her.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, doing all the hard work in a relationship of meeting somebody's parents, except without any of her support.
Right.
We feel all that. We go, great. He's done everything right. He deserves it. But I do think we all know as well intellectually that she, for her, that might as well have not have fucking happened.
Right. Exactly.
She's waking up in the next scene
mm-hmm.
after the previous scene where she's done no developing.
Right.
She's had no time to think about it. She's been in a fucking coma.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's pretty hard not to see, like, you don't want her as an audience member. You want her to just be like, but change your mind because he's really great. And I know you don't know that, but please just agree with us.
Well, and I think also one of the things that becomes really interesting when you look at it, and I had not thought about this. It's important to me that I don't pretend that I saw this one coming because it just came to mind as you were speaking. Largely what that looks like for her is her parents going, I think this is the one, you should marry him. And she goes, who, why? You know, I mean, they go, no, wow. Trust me. We vetted him.
Wow.
He's the one.
Oh my God. You're blowing my mind.
And I hadn't thought about
right
that,
now.
But yeah, that's essentially what that looks like to her.
Oof.
Is her parents being like, no, trust me. This is the guy.
Man, there's almost a missed opportunity in the movie.
I know.
Push that a little harder. But you're right. If you do this story from her perspective, I mean, really, she's probably we almost kind of get this hint of, you know, when he walks in the room, her mom is like, oh yeah, I know who you are. We know who you are.
Right. Exactly.
So they probably just had a conversation with her where she was like, this happened. This is terrible. I'm not seeing this guy. And they're probably like, good for you, fuck that guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then she blinks and they're like, actually, that guy is great because,
yeah.
Like you said, we've vetted him. We really think, oh, and he just happened to drop, look who's here. He just happened to drop by.
Yeah.
It is fucking precisely the situation he's in at home. Okay, let me ask you a fucking hard question then. What does that mean? I mean, what does that tell us about how we should judge this, right? Because we don't agree
we don't agree with situation A,
but we want more than situation B to happen,
and they're the same thing, just the movie spends 90 minutes on situation
well, just
B.
That we believe the parents in situation B have done better vetting.
Yeah,
which
I guess.
Think is okay. That's it's a cheat,
sure,
but it is okay to go, no, but this one
Sure.
They're right about.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that that's probably the closest thing. I mean, it's really easy to simplify it and be like, yeah, no, it's exactly a one-to-one, you know, comparison. It isn't. However, it is strikingly similar when that same thing was the rationale for the original breakup. Is my only, that's my point. And it doesn't answer your question, but it cowers me into a place where you can't reach me.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if, because it's definitely, it's not set up like she wakes up, her parents go, hey, guess what? You're marrying Kumail. You know?
Yeah.
It's not that bad.
Yeah.
But everybody's on his side when she went to bed, everybody, you know, was against him.
Yeah.
And the movie definitely alludes to, and I'm sure reality follows this path a little bit, but they probably had a lot of making up to do, had a lot of conversations, you know, probably started over like an awkward coffee around 2 p.m. And then, like, you know what I mean? We've done this. Like, we know how this goes.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take away the distressing parallel of the situation.
Yeah. Well, I think the things that when we really look at why it's not the same, those do become very important things. I mean, for starters, yeah, her parents show up and go, look, we've done the work. This guy's pretty great. But that doesn't change her mind. All of these decisions right. are completely left up to her. And when the two of them, you know, the worst fucking part of arranged marriage is removing the autonomy of the people it involves. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it's one thing, the element of how parents are intervening in the romantic lives of their children, maybe that's at play to some degree. But what makes it different is, you know, look at scenes where he meets these other people at the dinner table or the girl that he talks to, you know, when they really have a conversation about, oh yeah, so this arranged marriage, like what are we doing there? Mm-hmm. And they both kind of seem like not super into it. You know, they're reaching this decision for themselves. Had one of those girls thought that it was so right and she had a compelling case to make to him mm-hmm. about why he definitely should see her, then she would have done so and it would have reinstated some of that autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened is none of them felt that way because it's all kind of a fucking sham. Whereas in their own relationship, his relationship with Emily, you know, he had a case to make, and I feel like the things that he said and his own gestures of why this meant something to her ultimately won her over, convinced her that, you know, the things she was worried about the first time around aren't things to be worried about. And I think even it's even more than clarifying. I think it's kind of her sickness gave him a position where he could prove himself
sure.
in a way that, you know, it gave him that second chance in that mm-hmm. one single fucking respect, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that gave him the ability to kind of go, all right, well, look what I've been doing. Look what this has meant to me. And he was also very understanding when she goes, yeah, but you have to remember I wasn't there for any of that nonsense.
Right.
And I managed to retain a lot of that information even while bawling the entire time.
I mean, you just basically saw the movie in a very soft focus. It was sharper. It was a sharper film than maybe you saw.
How old are they in this movie? I know you're trying to transition. That's why I'm ruining your.
How old are they? Probably in their 20s, somewhere between 20 and 29.
And the way they meet is just like, you know, watch movies, make cute jokes, make out. Like it's sure. just. I don't know. I think part of it was also that I totally related to like being 20 and
because it was
like
in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, also, that yeah, might help. Is this just a Chicago thing? Maybe Chicago. Yeah, what you like, do? I know. Like,
I've done what you've yeah. done. This has been my life. Yeah.
It's cold, so you both go back to the apartment, and then one of you goes, yeah. "Don't look at the menu. There's spoilers in the menu."
Sure.
Which is, yeah. That's when I started yep. crying. Is there spoilers yeah. in the menu? Sorry, there was another movie you wanted to talk about.
Well, so a movie that was actually shot in a softer focus, but also a film that I think one of the major differences that I think is at play here. So we've already kind of talked about how these movies are very, very, very similar in a lot of regards. The major difference here to me is in the previous film, it is not a murderer who is responsible for the sort of main plot. Whereas in this film, it's the fucking most quintessential child murder looking fucking Stanley Tucci that ever walked the earth. It's almost like they were like, Stanley Tucci, how do you feel like a child murderer would look? And he's like, thinning hair, pedophile mustache, and creepy blue eyes.
Well, I think somebody else puts him in that costume.
Sure, I know. But I just mean, like, it's funny because the film, there is a certain, there's an aspect of the film where Daddy Wahlberg is going, who could it be? Who could have murdered my daughter? And like literally across the street from him is like, if you're like, hey Siri, draw a child molester.
You know what I love though about the costuming and every little choice around that is I think it gives him a little bit of room to do what would otherwise probably not be such a nuanced performance.
Sure.
As that murderer.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Because when the scenes that they do share together, when you know, when he's showing her the trapdoor, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at him, because he is kind of a picture of what you assume someone like that is, mm-hmm. like a cartoonish fucking representation.
Sure.
Then it gives him, acting wise, it gives him much broader. It gives him some breathing room to make other
because
choices.
His performance doesn't have to be do what you would do, but also you're a pedophile.
Yeah, right. Right. And
it takes that, but also you're a pedophile out of the performance because it is just on top of the performance, literally.
Thanks for that. Well, you know, it's a big bad wolf thing, right? It's like when you show up and you are in a wolf suit, then suddenly it's like, well, you can play that character just about however you want. You have a lot of flexibility because we're all looking at you knowing exactly what's going to happen. And I think his portrayal, I mean, that's some of my favorite stuff in the movie is when they're the kind of anxiety cuts, you know, looking at everything that's in that weird little bunker.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. It's
this is a heavy movie. I mean, it's amazing to me how heavy. I mean, I had only seen this movie, I think, one other time shortly after it came out.
Mm.
And then I remember one of my I remember three takeaways from this movie. And these are my three takeaways. Was holy fuck, that was heavy. I don't know if I can ever watch that again. That was one. Two, I believe at the time, my takeaway was something along the lines of that is my favorite Peter Jackson movie outside of his original trilogy.
Mm.
And then three, that movie was really shot beautifully. Are sort of the three things I took away. And rewatching this now and sort of trying to look at where this film lives in Peter Jackson filmography. So I think that's an important thing to me in this movie. Peter Jackson, for those of you just joining us in 2019 from a medically induced coma, Peter Jackson directed a very successful trilogy of films, Bad Taste, Dead Alive, and Meet the Feebles, and then went on to direct an even more successful trilogy of films, which was the Lord of the Rings trilogy. But right before Lord of the Rings, a couple films before, do you remember we did Heavenly Creatures on the show?
Of course.
So The Lovely Bones to me feels like, and it is this, so I guess it should feel like this, but if you want to talk about somebody with like a consistency of vision and execution, The Lovely Bones to me feels like the guy who directed Heavenly Creatures did three Lord of the Rings movies in between.
I see what you mean.
How I see The Lovely Bones is it's sort of this massively grandiose story in a tiny narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're essentially on a city block the whole time, but does it feel like that? Not even remotely. I mean, the world building in this film with no world is insane. And I think that is one of the most intangible it factors of this movie to me, is how big of a film this feels like for being, depressingly, what would be considered such a small event in the scope of cinema, right? We're talking about the murder of one person. So,
but
like,
also in television, that ends up being a miniseries.
Right, now, but not in 2009.
I see what you mean, though, about it being so grand, is before you even have the kind of supernatural crossing over speaking element.
Yeah.
Before you have the running through the fog, you
right.
could still do a, you know, a Fincher Netflix style
sure.
entire series about finding this murderer. And then once you say, oh, there's kind of a reaching over from the other side element to it, it just pushes it even more into a world that could be, you know, I could see the miniseries version of this or the extended kind of version of this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it is also a weird one for, it's rare for me these days that I see a new film that I haven't seen from people who are so in my orbit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the idea of a major Peter Jackson film that I just didn't get around to seeing is just not, it's not the kind of thing I come across for. I mean, I've known all of these people for a very long time. I've been watching all their movies.
Mm-hmm.
It's not some obscure side Peter Jackson movie. You know,
right,
this is
right.
a pretty big release. It's just surreal to me that there's something this monumental from this filmmaker that I haven't seen a fucking frame of and knew nothing about. Yeah, it's the girl from Lady Bird. It's based off a fucking beloved book.
Sure.
You know, it
sure.
is a much larger movie, even in that sense, than I feel like maybe people talk about today. Or maybe I've been completely blind to it.
I think too, and this is actually something I'm sort of realizing these two movies have in common. So I saw The Big Sick because everybody was like, whoa, go see The Big Sick. And then since became a huge Kumail Nanjiani fan, right?
Mm.
Peter Jackson, I've been on the dick of since Dead Alive.
Mm-hmm.
And not when that came out. I was literally 0 years old or some shit. But like when I saw it, then yeah. I was on the Peter Jackson dick, which was actually after the Lord of the Rings trilogy, which I was like, cool, these are long. But I think one of the things these two movies have in common, and it's also funny because it actually resonates to what you were just saying about your relationship with Peter Jackson and this film, is that both of these films, and I think it's summarized in a scene in this film where she's on the other side and she's talking to that girl and she goes, look what they did to me. I'm just the dead girl now.
Yeah.
You know, I'm nobody. I'm just the dead girl. And it's amazing because you look at a film like The Lovely Bones or a film like The Big Sick, and this event is monumental, literally life-changing. I mean, it changes the path of how everything is going. But if you're not looking, it's literally not even a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly to what you were saying about The Lovely Bones as a film upon its release, right? Like you look, when you are staring at The Lovely Bones, it is a huge film.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are looking backwards into cinema from 2020, you won't see it.
Yeah.
It's not on the radar.
Yeah, I didn't know if I was just like turning a blind eye every time I heard it and just going, haven't seen it. I couldn't believe that something this big had just passed right by it.
Well, and that kind of brings me back to what I was saying about my three takeaways. And we've never really explored this as an aspect of cinema, but do you think that there is a possibility that this film is just so hard, like so upsetting to watch, that people just don't want to go back to it? Like it's not revisitable? I mean, and we've done Martyrs and Irreversible, and those movies sure. are sort of like essentially emotional Jackass, right? You do it because you want to get kicked in the nuts and like it's hilarious.
But it's also midnight cinema.
Sure, right. That's what I'm saying. And The Big Sick, which you cried all the way through, I don't even hesitate to assume you would watch again because it's funny.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
but
let's look at
you
want to
talk comic relief in The Lovely Bones. That conversation is over because there is none.
You've just posed a question that I do actually think, unlike when you usually do this, and I go, I don't know how I feel. Let's float freely through a discussion of this. I actually feel like I might have a good handle on this because I've mentioned this a couple of times on the show before, but one of my weird pocket side interests that we never discuss is true crime.
Okay, yeah.
And I think that probably just...
Because you do like David Fincher, so...
Well, I also think that comes from, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts and you don't. And nope. The podcast space has just been completely dominated by true crime. And so, you know, here's a couple things about the true crime genre. When you look at true crime movies, which is kind of what the story of... Okay, let me broaden this back out just to cinema. We're talking about a killer that murders a victim and then the sort of finding the killer aspect of it. That's what I'm... Mm-hmm. True crime means a lot of things to a lot of people, but that's what I'm talking about here. The treatment of that, there is something in that community that happens that gets a lot of criticism, but nonetheless keeps happening, which is that these stories always focus on the murder and never the victim. And in the cinema space, I think the way these stories are told over and over, so much more commonly in podcasts, but even when they do come to cinema, you get something like the Netflix movie, Extremely Wicked, mm-hmm. Shockingly Evil and Vile, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where, I mean, I can't remember a single line in that movie about a victim, but the entire movie is like isn't Ted Bundy dreamy? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, that's what that movie's kind of going for. I don't want to pick on that one specifically, but we think about any of our movies about serial killers. People talk about serial killers. They're infatuated with serial killers or any kind of murderer because there's a number of reasons, but I feel like there's a question there of what makes a person do this. Who is this person? Who is this strange individual who crossed a line others do not cross and does a thing that seems like one of the, you know, cardinal things you cannot do? And everybody else is born with that sense of morality and that sense of I shall not do this. And some people aren't, and mm-hmm. they commit an unspeakable act. And for some of those reasons, I think that these movies tend to focus on killer and not victim. So when you have a story like this that is told from the aspect of the victim, one, I just think that's a really cool take. I think that's just a great way to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
If you tell the story from the victim's point of view, you can't take away their voice in a way that some of these other movies and, I don't know, writings and so forth about this seem to.
Mm-hmm.
It's not lost on me that these people are interesting and we're not coming to this to read about the victim, but still, I think that's important. You know, I say all of this to say that there is something pulpy and digestible about not thinking about the victim.
Yeah.
And I think that is truly why we don't spend a lot of time considering who they were and how tragic it is that they've gone.
Mm-hmm.
The voiceover in this is talking about, I mean, it's basically going, look, here, I was a person. Now I'm a nothing. Now I have been extinguished. And that is fucking hard. Mm-hmm. And even when I was over in London, I became really interested in all the Jack the Ripper killings. It's a really interesting part of Whitechapel and part of London. And, you know, just looking at that and thinking about that, you kind of go to it going, who was this guy? And, you know, why did this happen? But it would be so much more difficult to really go on a fucking Jack the Ripper tour.
Right.
If you spent it, if the fucking tour guide was a victim from one of the murders,
mm-hmm.
and you spent the first 40 minutes going through all her life and her hopes and her dreams and the hard times she fell on, but today she's going to make a difference. Today she's going to turn it around, and then she's fucking brutally murdered. then you don't get to the end and go, oh, and they took a crime scene photo. Who wants to look at it?
Right.
You know, oh, let's talk about the ways this body was mangled. Like, those are the pulpy parts of this, this kind of genre that I feel like, I don't know, there's just something interesting here in that it's so digestible and so, again, pulpy. Oh, fucking terrible phrase to use for this. But it is such pulp fiction that we can even wind up to a point where we're like, oh, so the story you've been interested in, did you know there's a photo of this mangled body? Who'd like to see it? Mm-hmm. And some people are like, yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, I'm just enjoying this whole ride here. It's a mindset to get another human being in that you, I feel like you can only do once you've completely sucked all the humanity out of that story. So to answer your question, I think what makes this movie heavy and maybe not revisitable is that you have to think about this person's life. You have to think about who they were, and you're basically spending the runtime of the movie kind of being bummed with them that they died.
Sure. I am being bummed with them about all the people who are bummed that they died.
Which is the more important story to me. That is more important than us studying killers and seeing, oh, what makes them tick, which we never fucking get to the bottom of. And the entire body of this type of, I keep wanting to call it fiction, but the, you know, fiction based on infamous murders, we never really, we don't watch Extremely Wicked and like really figure out what, we got to watch this and figure out who Ted Bundy was to make sure it doesn't happen. We're not doing that. We're not really learning anything about this. We're just, we're being tantalized. We're doing the martyrs thing, you know?
Right, right.
We're kind of going, ooh, can you believe how shockingly evil and vile this is with like a devilish grin, you know? It's like, oh, want to be bad and watch some true crime.
Yeah, it's like that South Park episode where all the adults watch true crime and get like, get off on it. Like they turn on true crime and then like jerk off with each other.
Is that a thing?
Yes.
I don't remember that.
Yes, it is.
Oh my God.
Yeah. They like turn on true crime to get in the mood.
I mean, there you have it. If South Park has nailed it, then.
So then shall it be.
The third point that you talked about is very, very much around, you know, aesthetics. So
sure,
we don't need to talk about it too much. But this is, this pulls a lot of great kind of Crutzen imagery. Gregory Crutzen. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but look up his photos. I've sent you some of them. Actually, they're very kind of suburban takes.
Okay,
but they are extremely cinematically lit. And the stuff outside at night with these giant pools of light and all of this fog, they're very much, you know, in that vein. And he talks about kind of similar, there's a similar sort of seedy underbelly of suburbia, the quiet, intimate, unspoken, you know, problems or personal problems of people who live away from cities. Very interesting photography. But as far as the soundscape goes, it's a Brian Eno score. Who was, and I guess still is, a Brian Eno, still alive. God, what am I doing? ambient musician, you know, electronic musician, very often experimental music, but I mean all the way back since the 70s.
Yep.
He did stuff with the Talking Heads, Bowie, Damon Albarn. He created the Microsoft sound, you know. Brian Eno's been instrumental, you know, the sound when your fucking Windows computer starts up. But it just in terms of pointing people, I guess, towards more aesthetic things that, and tonal things that we don't have to elaborate on. Maybe check out Music for Airports, an album he did. His music's really, actually, we were talking about Fincher, very influential in that that Nine Inch Nails score, kind of, when they started doing Ghosts and things like that. I think Music for Airports was actually done as, like, the idea was a sound installation that they could put in airports to make them, you know, more chill and less anxiety inducing or something crazy.
Yeah.
Anyways, just interesting artists, Crutzen and Brian Eno, whose work influenced and in Brian's case were in the film. Oh my God. Double feature.
All right. Well, we do have a website. It is, like you said many times, doublefeature.fm. There's also an email if you want to get at us about, I don't know, why we pair movies or what the fuck ever. It's doublefeatureshow@icloud.com.
How was this pair? This is a good week to tell us how was this pair. But Michael, who are the executive producers of the show?
The executive producers of this episode of Double Feature are Seth Hanasek, Mike Shaw, Dust, the Abbot of Unreason, Charles Crawford.
All those people got lovely boned out of here. And you know who's getting lovely boned is our show. Guys, we need some help over here. That is the Abbot of Unreason, Ben Ecker, Brett Hayden, Charles Crawford, John, and Tom Leonard. And we have to get the fuck out of here. So I'm just going to tell you, next episode, we'll give you a tonal double feature. It is A Simple Plan and Logan Lucky.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.